And I listen to Innerside Radio with Scooter because you know why? It don't suck.
Thank you.
But it's such a fucking, it's just, rehab is just such fraud. It's just this cottage industry of nonsense, junk science. Dr. Drew Pinsky should be just, he's like, I've never done a bit about someone. First, you do bits and you fake anger and you write a bit and you have passion for it. And then you do it too many times and then you have to work up the anger. And I've never had to do that with talking about Dr. Drew Pinsky for years. I just hearing his name, his bile comes out of me because it started. If there's a war on drugs, he's the Joseph Goebbels propaganda minister of lies. And it started out with just a celebrity rehab, and that was it's a dumb show. But what made it important, Dr. Drew is a real doctor. That's what you have to keep in mind. He's not a fake Dr. Phil. He's an actual, went to medical school, has a diploma over his desk, real doctor spreading this nonsense. And it started with celebrity rehab, which was a guilty pleasure. It was fun to watch. They, cull in all these D-level celebrities, let them shake off the DTs for a couple of days with cameras in their faces 24/7. And then they'd send them boating with Gary Busey. Because that's what a medical professional would tell you to do in that situation. And instead of being stripped of his credentials for this, instead of being drug out in the street and beaten and tied shirtless to a telephone pole out front of this place so garage bands could staple flyers to his chest to promote their upcoming gig, and then the other band would draw a dick picture on the thing, and they'd tear that off and put up a new poster, and eventually Drew Pinsky would die the slow, bleeding death of 1,000 weeping pinholes. Instead of that happening, what happened is it gave him credibility. People took him seriously. And that's what makes you crazy. It's not that these buffoons exist in life, but the fact that, like the Sarah Palins or the Glenn Becks or whoever, where you go, if everyone was laughing at him, you go, but when they're taking, Drew Pinsky now is the go-to guy for any kind of celebrity, any Heath Ledger issue, any Michael Jackson. He's the guy that the mainstream media goes to. Joining us tonight to talk about one of the Corys that died. We don't know which Corey. No one really cares. But to discuss the tragedy, joining us tonight, celebrity rehabilitation expert, Dr. Drew Pinsky. Welcome to the show. First of all, how are you a celebrity rehabilitation expert? How do you get that designation? At what point in medical school did your professor pull you to the side? Drew, mirror a second. I want to talk to you. Listen, I've been watching you work. I've been watching you poke around the cadavers and do what you do with a smug look on your face. Did anyone ever tell you that you have a keen eye for the rich and famous? You should really go in that direction. I think you have a natural gift to be an ambulance chaser to the stars and would step over a dozen dying winos in the street just to get to Lindsay Lohan's bedside to offer unsolicited advice to Charlie Sheen via Twitter as a medical professional is wont to do. Yeah, Dr. Drew Pinsky. Celebrity rehabilitation expert. And what they don't show you when they're treating this, remember, this is a deadly disease. Addiction is, here it comes again, watch. This might look like a choice, but it's not. This is a deadly affliction. There's no such thing as addiction. I mean, on the most minor levels, if you're a hardcore substance abuser, there is a physical addiction where you might need a medical detox for a few days so you don't seizure up and swallow your tongue. After that, it's done. Then it's a choice. It's right back to a choice. There's no such thing as addiction. There's only things that you enjoy doing more than life. And it's not just drugs and alcohol, sex addiction. Eat too much pie. It's what you want to do. And what they don't show you in any of these shows is What do you do with these people? You have all these shows exploiting dads. You know, Intervention. Intervention's an hour-long show, and 52 minutes of it is some stumble bum being followed around by a camera, puking in trash cans and losing his job, because that's fun to watch. It really is. It's easily exploitable. That's why cigarettes are far more dangerous than anything that they show in Intervention, but you don't see that episode. There's not the cigarette. Because no one wants to watch 52 minutes of a guy going... It's killing me. So they have to get the stumble bum knocking over the turkey at his Aunt Nancy's house on Thanksgiving morning because he's trying to drink her mouthwash. Because it's fun to watch. But then what they don't ever show you is the cure. If these shows are supposed to be informational and educational, what do you do? What's the cure? You show me 52 minutes of the guy being hilarious, and then you fast forward through the intervention part, because no one wants to watch that. That's just boring idiot family members reading Hallmark cards they wrote themselves. And then you didn't show up to Sherry's graduation. So what happened? And the only cure they show, oh, yeah. Then we flew him to Palos Altos, California for rehab, and he hasn't drank since 2007. Well, what'd you do there? That might be a good focal point of the show, is the cure for this deadly disease. What is the cure, Dr. Drew? Tell me what you're going to do with Charlie Sheen if you get him. How do you cure these people? All you do is show me, you know, boating with Gary Busey. What's the cure? Well, we get him involved we put him in a rehab. Well, what do you do in the rehab? Well, it's a treatment. Well, what is the treatment? Well, we get him involved in a program. Stop with the buzzwords and tell me what exactly is the cure. Oh, the cure specifically is God. What? What? Yes, God. That's what you do? That's all they do. All these rehabs, all they do is funnel you into a 12-step program, AA and the like, and any 12-step program is a God-based program. It's like 7 of the 12 steps are about God and giving your life to God. You're a medical doctor with a diploma over your desk. You treat one thing and one thing only, and the only cure you have for it is God. Even your religious friends do not want to hear about God during a medical diagnosis. That's the last word you ever want to hear from a doctor. God, Doc, my lymph nodes are swollen out of my neck. I look like a bullfrog. I can't keep food down. Ooh, sounds like someone needs a higher power. Can't we do some blood work first? Series of antibiotics? Get a CAT scan? Nope, get on your knees and pray. You're a doctor? Yep, I'm on TV too.
That was Dr. Drew is the Medicine with David Blaine is the Science, a cut from Doug Stanhope's new album, Before Turning the Gun on Himself. That was most of the cut. I had to make a few snips and circumcisions to play it on the air so it wouldn't be indecent, which is why they take the U out of FCC. Doug Stanhope, many people say he's the greatest working stand-up comedian right now. And I agree. Dark, twisted, and funny. Take you places you thought you'd only been alone. I saw him twice last year, about 7 months apart, and he only repeated a few jokes. That's unheard of in stand-up. Anyway, that's available on Amazon and iTunes and wherever quality entertainment is downloaded. Doug Stanhope, Before Turning the Gun on Himself. Which reminds me, it's been about 7 years since Hunter Thompson made his splashy exit from Planet Weird. I didn't mention the anniversary last month because we were at Fun Drive, and as long as we're on the subject of merciless humor, I thought I'd read this eulogy to the old master. I ran across it in Exiled last week. This was written by John Dolan in 2005, who just reposted it on exiledonline.com. It runs along the same line Stanhope was drawing, so here's John Dolan from ExiledOnline.com talking about one of America's greatest and, like Doug Stanhope, a genuine American role model for our children. Dr. Hunter S. Thompson, a hero of our time. You wouldn't have guessed he'd shoot himself, but it made sense after the fact. He always meant what he said, and he always had guns around. It was right that he used one to blow his brains out. I can't remember the last time a celebrity death made me sad like this. I've been meaning to write a tribute to him, because I consider him a great and underrated writer. Too late now. Still, it was an honorable and gory end. A good conclusion. He'd already lasted about 40 years longer than he expected to, and much, much longer than the mainstream wanted him to. Ever since he got famous and kept saying openly that he loved and used speed, they'd been waiting eagerly to see him turn into something they could use to scare the kids back to nice, dumb, cell-toxic booze. They were willing to tolerate a discreet stoner. Marijuana users are pitifully harmless people, but not a smart, tough, 6'3" redneck who sang the praises of the hard stuff. In fact, one of my favorite comments that he made about drugs was that he could write effectively on every drug except marijuana. It irked them. The way you refuse to die, go dramatically insane, become crippled or recant. Way back in the 70s, people were saying, oh, he's through. He's really fried his brain. That was all you ever heard from the millions of cowards who were going through the recommended transition from druggie to real estate agent. Oh, Hunter's lost it. I heard he OD'd. Well, he hadn't lost it. He kept writing well, better than they could. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is the best post-1945 novel I know, with Dog of the South and Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch as its only real competition. Thompson, waxing boastful in his old age, claimed it was as good as Great Gatsby. I'd say he was being absurdly modest. It's vastly better than that rusting hulk welded a preppy bathos. There's Huckleberry Finn, and then there's Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And note that they're very similar books, these two great American novels, both hilarious, both steeped in intimate scorn for the culture they deride, both written by tough Southern boys who were too smart, honorable, and cocky to fall for the Southern mythos, or the Northern one. Thompson took all that was good about the South, personal honor, toughness, gun love, jokes, and abandoned once and for all the vile baggage that went with it, without whining about his loss. He backed Ron Dellums for VP in 72 and never even thought about going back to the Dixieland schmaltz when it became fashionable again at the turn of the millennium. Can anybody else's culture hero say as much? Can Orwell, that oft-cited example of journalistic virtue? Thompson was not only a far better writer than Orwell, he was a far better man. Orwell felt that his conversion to socialism made it acceptable to keep all the other nasty bigotries of his background and made a point of hating everyone his nanny had taught him to hate, from the Irish to the Wogs to women. Thompson dropped all his childhood prejudices and fought, in many cases literally physically fought, racism whenever he came across it. And typically, he never bemoaned his loss of innocence, nor became a mealy-mouthed progressive, an extraordinary bit of navigation through four decades of treacherous ideological snags. A feat worthy of his sole peer, the river pilot Mark Twain. In one of his last books, Kingdom of Fear, he said the only druggies still honest enough to credit their chemical muses were him and William Burroughs. But as with Gatsby, he was too generous. Truth is, he was the only one. Burroughs loved to pose with guns and play up his junkie shtick, but ended up sniveling to be cured of his addiction and wrote in praise of the medical gurus who weaned him off the dope. Not Thompson. He never recanted. We make the Hollywood commies of the 50s into heroes for refusing to grovel or snitch, but that's only because commies just don't matter. Try to think of a hero who stood up to the drug cops and the medieval insanity they unleashed. A hero who never denied using drugs or enjoying them, never denied that they helped him enormously in his work, never backed down, even at the peak of the witch hunt. This is a list of one. Dr. Hunter S. Thompson. That's practical bravery. Bravery in the face of real, virulent, popular oppression. Do you see the difference? 67 years old and he was still going so strong, it took a bullet in the head to stop him. A half century on speed? It's an awesome achievement in itself. Never mind the writing. Yeah, speed, I'll say it again. Since this crucial word seems to be left out of every other obituary I've read, speed. All the ex-druggies who run the California press, eager to airbrush the decades spent high on speed and coke from their official biographies, are squirming to find some way to avoid the word. The San Francisco Chronicle even managed to find someone who quoted Thompson as saying, "Adrenaline is our real drug of choice." Nice try. But let's try to be a bit honest, guys, just for a few minutes, in his honor. His drug of choice was speed. Crystal meth, amphetamines, you know it. You've all taken it. And not one of you will admit that you love it, that you've written on it, and that you've had the best times of your life on it. That was his gimmick, telling the truth. It's something that would never occur to people who run the San Francisco Chronicle. That's all Thompson's new journalism was, telling the truth about what it was like to be a reporter. Every other American journalist saved his real juicy stuff for the boys on the bus and fobbed off press releases and other garbage on the sucker readers. They do it instinctively. It literally would not occur to them to go about the job in any other way. America is the perfect Soviet society with a built-in disconnect between what a reporter knows and jokes about while drinking and drugging it with the insiders and what he tells the losers out there. Thompson was simply brave enough to do the obvious, which was so obvious no one else dreamed of doing it. Telling us the whole juicy experience of being on the press bus, being one of the insiders. That is what columnists mean when they say he became a gonzo journalist and abandoned objectivity, simply that he told the druggy, boozy, rumor-fueled truth that they all preferred to save for each other. And in doing so, he actually made the filthy, dull slaughterhouse work of American politics seem worth reading about. Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, 1972, is still worth reading, long after its principal characters are dead. Not for its account of the election, but just to savor the amphetamine rhythm of Thompson's life on the road, in the bus, the highs, the hotel paranoid moments, the crashes. He tells a speed crash better than anyone except maybe Philip K. Dick. And there, maybe, is a fit companion for him, Philip K. Dick. Both were smart and lucky enough to be in the Bay Area just as it took flame in the mid-60s. Both were a little bit older than the average callow hippie, and that saved them. I recently read Thompson's early letters in The Proud Highway and was amazed to see how brilliantly he avoided all the pitfalls of the hippie trail. And God, there were a lot of pitfalls. There was the gullible folly of becoming a naive believer in the charismatic dictators of the moment. Thompson stayed a hard leftist all his life, but mocked, in his letters, friends who swooned at the feet of third-world dictators. Then there was the lotus eater slide into the drooling hedonism. He was astonishingly deft at avoiding that one, taking his share of sex and stoner idols without ever losing his hard-scrabble drive to keep writing. In fact, you'll find him remarkably terse about sex, compared to any other hippie-era writer. He had more and boasted less than anyone I could think of. And most treacherous of all was the shallow, unconcealed pit labeled Return to Airbrush Safe Career. He never took that one. It's almost as if, could this be possible? It's almost as if he wasn't scared. How could there be an American who wasn't scared? Scared is what we are. It's our DNA, but not his. One of his last columns described the long sequence of humiliating searches and interrogations he endured before boarding a flight to Hawaii. It's a beautiful passage. He remembers how fondly Americans used to be able to go anywhere they wanted, without fear, without explaining themselves to anyone. I don't know if it's really true, but it's wonderful to imagine. Just the idea of an American not being scared, that's wonderful in itself. But I fear he was the last one.
Down with disease, 3 weeks in my bed, trying to stop these demons that keep dancing in my head.
A hero of our time, Hunter S. Thompson, written by John Dolan. First published in The Exile in February 2005 and recently reposted at exiledonline.com. Doug Stanhope performing, Dr. Drew is the medicine, what David Blaine is the science, a cut from his new album, Before Turning the Gun on Himself. This has been the Innerside Radio Program. This and all other Innerside Radio Programs are archived on the Inner Tubes. Simply Google The Inner Side. Pod people, check out Houston's premier comedy podcast, The Whiskey Brothers. Go to praisewhiskey.com. Like the Innerside Radio Program, you should play it really loud on your computer at work. And don't forget to make CDs for your children to share.
You want to listen to KPFT's Democracy Now, but have to drive the kids to school with the radio.
Continuing on with the, I guess the theme of the show. I'm not sure what the theme of the show is. I think it's drug-fueled craziness and how that went. And, of course, it fits right in that Peter Bergman died last week. Fire Sign Theater completely changed the way that people do and listen to radio. Probably Fire Sign Theater is the biggest influence, absolutely, on my whole consciousness of how audio is done. They were back in the late 60s, early 70s. And I actually have some great Peter Bergman stories, and I was going to tell them. But, you know, I'd rather just play some Fire Sign Theater, and we'll get into to how they influenced culture and, you know, actually how spectacular and central they were in changing the way that things were done. Maybe next week when I have more of them to play. So let me put some Fire Sign Theater on here.
I don't know how you came by this record, but you are now embarked upon a journey that must certainly lead you to change your life forever. If you were never a special person, you are a special person now. Hello, Seeker. Now don't feel alone here in the New Age, because there's a Seeker born every minute. Yes, I'm Dr. Happy Harry Cox, and call me happy because I am. Because you're listening to another in a series of my mind-breaking records, Men Never Lived on Earth, which started off with I Came From Outer Space, followed by Strangers at Our Door, which includes the ultra-high-speed recording of real gas music from Jupiter. If you haven't got them, buy them now. I was right about the comet. Get them and see why. Write me here in my award-winning communication trailer, Space Nyan, Blue Mouse Trailer Resort, Hellmouth, California, 90666.
Dogs flew spaceships.
The Aztecs invented the vacation.
Men and women are the same.
Our forefathers took drugs.
Your brain is not the boss.
Yes,
that's right.
Everything you know is wrong.
Hello, Seekers. Here we go again. And hello especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe that pigs live in trees and that faithful Rover is nothing but a pet sleeping by the doggy door. Well, doggone it, he's smarter than you'll ever be. Yes, I've got proof here that his ancestors came from the dog star millions of years ago to rule the earth. He's been there. And you probably don't even know where you are. Don't believe it? Well, listen to this.
Well, at first I thought it was a big old dog, because of the way it howled and how it had them big friendly eyes. But I had to ask myself what the hell I was doing up in the graveyard, digging up the ground with a shovel. Thought I was crazy. I'm not a drinking man on duty, Mr. Cox, not me. You know, I figured it was one of them werewolves we're having, so I slipped a wooden load in my shotgun, and then all of a sudden, now this is going to sound crazy, a big dark shape with flashing lights come up over the top of the hill. That went right over there. It's about 100 miles an hour. This dog, or wolf, or whatever it was, it took off like a bug rabbit with that dry hump over there. Hey, Deputy, just a minute, will you? I'm not a drinking man, Mr. Cox. I swear to hell I saw it.
That was no crazed sterno bum, but a respected law enforcement officer, Sheriff Luger Axhandle of Heater County, California. And that wooden marker over the grave where the creature was digging? It bore a mysterious inscription. Much faded with time and wormholes, it read, "No name, died 1897, with this curious epitaph, not from around here, but a real square little feller." Now, I tracked down this story to Lem Ashhauler, who's editor of the Hellmouth Heater Democrat.
Back here someplace, Chuckles. Y'all are published monthly back then. There's a lot happening, you know.
Oh, 1897.
It's a big yellow jacket epidemic.
Oh, really?
That was very fashionable in those days.
April 19th.
Yeah, it's a bunch of funny storms. Wait a minute. Here it is. April 19th, 1897. Strange occurrence at Proctor's Well. Yeah, all this story pops up about every 10 years or so. Happened over in Curio, Arizona, about 20 miles the other side of the river.
Yeah.
Came crawling out of a well wearing ladies' shoes. Uh-huh. Didn't know what milk was.
Repeated everything anybody said.
Well, I'm reading it. Real little, smooth like baby's feet, with big friendly eyes. He sounds like a real nice guy. Took him to the Swiss picnic for a good time, and he choked to death on a piece of cheese. And then the end of the story.
Curio, Arizona, crumbling remnant of the Old West, or could it be the final resting place of a little guy from outer space? Could be. All I know is everything you know is wrong. Think your children are as innocent as a new puppy next door? Well, they know something you don't know. They know that their American forefathers took drugs, and you probably don't even know where your father is.
Ernie Blackland Films presents Ben Franklin, hero for Hophead.
I wanted the woods and the Indians to sleep with me. But I was afraid of the cold and made them sleep outside. So I never felt the touch of a warm, naked Indian or in a cold, naked forest.
Ben Franklin, the only president of the United States who was never president of the United States. Was he an early drug user? Let's see. He wrote of it in Poor Dick's Conspiracy in 1761, while still an apprentice bookmaker in colonial Philadelphia.
So I betook me to the Hashfire Inn for a secret caucus of the hotheads, rebellious libertines all, lusting for life and liberty. The real George Washington brought to him had already the evening papers. We quickly proceeded to get Sarah Meadows and young Tom Everson goodly stretched by the hemp, which smoked us all like Boston scrot. What a fetid fervor of freedom.
I say, let's have a revolution.
Statement by Sam, the tax collector, to which Big Ben replied,
"Fine, Sam. Then we can invite over a bunch of immigrants and make cars."
Yes, 1761.